the Allstate Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for June the 16th, 2019. A very happy Father's Day to everyone out there. This is our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we go from City Hall to the State House and all the way on to the White House. So time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee this morning, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, a happy Father's Day, as I said, to everybody out there. And Dave, a special happy Father's Day to your dad. He is quite the gentleman.
Thank you very much. And I know he's listening right now, so he is accepting your good wishes.
And I know you will treat him to a great meal today.
I've already had the dinner picked out.
Excellent. Excellent. No, did you get him any, like, a new tie or anything like that?
He's got the tie from 1964 yet, and the socks around, let's see, 1971, I think. So, he's in good he's in good shape that way.
One of the most dapper gentlemen I know.
He takes pride in his appearance, and he likes to tell the story about one time when he was in waiting at a doctor appointment, and a total stranger walked up to him in the waiting room and said, "I just want to compliment you on the fact that you have come here looking presentable and decent. You know that, that you take some pride." In Europe, well, that made his day. And, you know, how about it? We live in a very casual age these days. But
When you'd get dressed up to go on a plane?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. In fact, I remember, oh, boy, this goes back a long time. Because we had relatives on the West Coast, we would fly out to Seattle or San Francisco or Portland on a vacation. Dad would wear a suit.
Oh, sure.
You were on an airplane. You were in the public eye. So, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, it's...
Mom would wear a dress.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it was kind of like those Sunday Hawk games back at the old stadium, too, where people were dressed up for those.
Oh, yeah. And you look at the pictures we have around the station here from, old Wrigley Field pictures or a parade on State Street where WGN was covering it live. All of the men wearing ties, you bet.
Yeah,
it's you listening, Joe.
I was gonna say I've seen the old black and white photos of wearing suits and hats at ball games. What are these guys doing?
That's what you did.
We should bring it back.
See, Joe, Dave and I still live in a black and white world, I think is what it is.
Not sepia tone.
that helps. Yes, a little wistful sepia tones there, but Joe, welcome to the show this morning, and I'm congratulated all of my friends down in St. Louis for their first ever Stanley Cup. It seems like it's been a year ago now.
Boy, they really rubbed it in, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. They did. Bennington, their goalie, just proved to be exceptional.
Yeah, yeah, especially in that last game, you really have to tip your cap to him. It was just such a hard Stanley Cup to find a rooting interest for.
Yes.
I took the route of, just supporting the former co-worker, Judd Cerrone, right, being the voice of the Boston Bruins, so I was going for him in that regard. But, I mean, it is still a cool story, even though it is the St. Louis Blues. It's kind of been tough for Chicago the past couple of years because the Milwaukee Bucks have been a very easy team to like. So have the Milwaukee Brewers. Now the St. Louis Blues, it's like you don't want to root for these guys, but the storyline just still kind of triumphs all.
Yeah, no, I mean, first ever Stanley Cup. And as I told everybody, I said, enjoy the moment because you don't know when or if it's ever going to happen again.
Right.
And also think about all of those that aren't around anymore that were diehard fans and didn't get to enjoy that moment.
I'll say one of the weirdest things is seeing so much blue in St. Louis. It's just kind of funny how, it's so contrasting with Cardinal red and St. Louis blue, and then for the most part, for a big chunk of Chicago, it's the Cubs being blue and the Blackhawks being red, you know, kind of that reverse trend.
That's an interesting thought.
You know?
Yeah.
Because like the Winter Classic, when the Hawks were down in St. Louis, it was so weird seeing all that blue around Busch Stadium, and then you're rooting for the red team.
Good point. Good point. And how about Toronto with the big NBA championship?
Yeah.
And Fred VanVleet from Rockford?
Yeah, what a cool story that
and
was.
And getting a Rockford shout-out there at the end of the game?
Did you see what Rockford was doing for the last couple of games for their watch parties?
Yeah, they were doing the Jurassic Park.
That is thing, so cool.
Which, I don't know what they drew for the last game, but they had drawn like 5,000 people downtown and set up big screens and all of that.
And that's such a proud little area. Not even really little. I mean, it's larger than a suburban area, but it's such a proud, close-knit community. It's really cool to see them all come together for something like that and be focused on the national stage, really.
Yeah, well, and it was a national story. There was a great piece, and I think it was in Forbes, about just everybody coming together for this. And good for Rockford. Good for Rockford.
I agree.
And one of these days, I'm going to get out there for an Ice Hogs game.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good time over there. I spent a little bit of time doing some minor league baseball in Rockford. And one of the teams we play, the Beloit Snappers, they're not too far away from Rockford either. So it's got a little big sports twist over there.
Joe, I'm so old. I was at the Rockford Register Star when they were bringing a minor league affiliate.
Wow.
To Rockford.
Which one was that? Was it the Royals?
No, that was the Expos affiliate.
Okay, the Rockford Expos. Because they've affiliated the Cubs, Royals, and Expos, right? I think the Reds, too, maybe.
Well, the Expos, that was the first... The first team coming in.
What are the Expos?
Well,
I'm kidding.
Yeah, thank you very much. Going back to the black and white world, right? And I'm covering.
What are the Expos?
I'm covering a park district meeting because they didn't have a big stadium built yet, and so they were going to play the first year in a park district facility, and one of the owners said to me, well, there was a restriction. They couldn't sell alcohol in a park district facility, so they were seeking a waiver of that. And one of the owners said to me, why don't you write a story about you were in Springfield? You know what minor league baseball is like. I said, I don't think you want me to write about the time they had 10-cent beer night down in Springfield. He goes, yeah, save that story. Thank you. So
Rockford needs a 10-cent beer night.
Well, to celebrate the Raptors.
Yeah.
You know, that's very classic. Cubs finally pull one off. What a horrible road trip this has been.
Yeah, it's pretty jarring how different they play at home and on the road. I mean, 1-4 on this road trip. Luckily, they had that explosive game against Colorado. But heck, last night it looked like it was going to be kind of the same old story with the struggling offensive woes. And if you're going to be Kenley Jansen, that's the way to do it. Catch him on one mistake on a hit-by-pitch and then just a hanging slider that's deep enough to get over. They kind of stole one there last night.
Yeah, I think so. And here again, I guess, you know, everybody must love the Cubs because I think this is the third Sunday in a row they're on Sunday Night Baseball.
I know the Cubs probably aren't loving it, though.
No. But, the Sox were doing a pretty good job. They're owning the Yankees so far in this series.
They're on a very good run, reaching .500. Had a chance to get above last night, but, I mean, three straight. And Lucas Giolito, man, is this guy stealing the show. There's a very good chance he'll be starting in Cleveland for the Midsummer Classic.
Oh, you got to think. You got to think.
It's so cool how much he's improved from last year.
Well, that's it. When you look at that, you know, year-to-year comparison, it's night and day. Just fantastic, fantastic stuff. And it's what I said about the Sox season this year. I said, you know, it's going to be a tough season, probably, you know, a .500 ball club, but they're going to be fun to watch.
Right. And this is something we talked about yesterday morning, too. It's Rick Hahn at the beginning of the year said, it's not so much what record we have, it's the storylines to getting to that record. And so many positives have already been pulled from through the first 70 games with Eloy Jimenez, Yoan Moncada, Lucas Giolito, Tim Anderson. I mean, there's so many cool things to be positive about this team. So all the winning is just a bonus.
Well, so you got your Major League Baseball, and then I get an email yesterday from Sam Paniatovich Sr.,
Oh, boy.
Okay. Who let me know that, now we know Sam Jr., of course, that used to be here in the sports department. Other brother, though, Adam, has been named as the captain of the Serbian national baseball team.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
And that they are going to be heading to Bulgaria starting in July, playing in these kind of European championship games that could ultimately determine a spot in the 2020 Tokyo Olympics.
That is so cool. What a cool story, because I know he was in the White Sox organization for a little bit, and now he's doing some coaching and scouting, I believe. Oh, that's so cool. What a cool story.
So, yeah, it's and there's a lot of other Chicago area players, ball players that are part of this, and yeah, they're getting packed ahead to fly over from JFK over to Bulgaria for I mean, that's just a classic story, isn't it?
Right. What an experience that's going to be.
Yeah,
that's so
absolutely.
Cool.
So I know there's a proud papa in Sam Panayotovich Sr. Today on Father's Day, and certainly a proud mother with Cindy as well. So good luck to them as they take on Europe in the competition over there. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. As I said, Joe is in for Andy, and he'll have the latest sports. Producer Ro is in for Cassara, and she's fielding your calls at 312-981-7200. You can text us at that line, 312-981-7200. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is still trying to dry his umbrella. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break on this Father's Day Sunday. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Time to launch our weekly spin through national politics, and it's been another wild week in Washington. Sarah Huckabee Sanders leaving her White House podium to return to Arkansas, while Kellyanne Conway keeps her job as a senior advisor to the president, despite a recommendation that she be fired for mixing politics with government in violation of the Hatch Act. And then, of course, was the president. In an exclusive interview with ABC's George Stephanopoulos, the president says he would listen to dirt from foreign governments against a campaign opponent. Here's what he told George Stephanopoulos.
Okay, let's put yourself in a position. You're a congressman. Somebody comes up and says, hey, I have information on your opponent. Do you call the FBI?
I'll tell you what,
I've seen a lot of things over my life. I don't think in my whole life I've ever called the FBI. In my whole life. You don't call the FBI. You throw somebody out of your office. You do whatever.
Al Gore got a stolen briefing book. He called the FBI.
Well, that's different. A stolen briefing book. This isn't this is somebody that said, we have information on your opponent. Oh, let me call the FBI. Give me a break. Life doesn't work that way.
The FBI director says that's what should happen.
The FBI director is wrong.
Your campaign this time around, if foreigners, if Russia, if China, if someone else offers you information on an opponent, should they accept it or should they call the FBI?
I think maybe you do both. I think you might want to listen. There's nothing wrong with listening. If somebody called from a country, Norway, we have information on your opponent. Oh, I think I'd want to hear it.
You want that kind of interference in our elections?
It's not an interference. They have information. I think I'd take it.
So that's the president, who then later went on to Fox News and kind of backtracked a little bit, but then acknowledged, well, he'd listen first and then see whether he should call the FBI or not. Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, of course, no fan of the president, who celebrated his 73rd birthday Friday. She said Trump's comments are another indication that the president doesn't know the difference between right and wrong.
And what the president said last night shows clearly, once again, over and over again, that he does not know the difference between right and wrong. And that's probably the nicest thing I can say about him. Because if he doesn't know the difference, it could explain some of his ridiculous behavior. And now to invite further involvement of foreign governments into our election. There was an assault on our democracy, an assault on our country by the Russians That has been clearly documented by the intelligence community. And the President of the United States, instead of coming to the defense of our democracy, has said it's a hoax. This is beyond, I mean, it's really, there is no sense of what's the word I wanted to find? Any ethical sense that informs his comments and his thinking.
That's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Joining me here in the studio is Andrea Durbin. She is the CEO of the Illinois Collaboration on Youth. Andrea, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, first, why don't you just explain what the Collaboration on Youth is?
Sure. We are a group of community-based providers who serve families and children inside the DCFS system, and also they work with kids and families who are outside of the system as well. So families who are at risk of or involved in child welfare, juvenile justice, homelessness, serious mental health issues, things like that. So families that are struggling across Illinois.
Now, obviously, a whole lot of heightened attention was recently placed on DCFS over the agency's interaction and with family and child deaths.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is just an agency that seems to have been in perpetual struggle. And lawmakers did approve more money for more hiring of caseworkers, those kinds of things. But I guess, you know, when you are able to step back at and look at this, is it just money?
It's not just money. And it's maybe hard to believe right now, but at one point, Illinois was a leader nationally in the child welfare field. And it's been many years since we've been a leader. And in fact, in some measures of child safety and permanency, we are last in the nation, which is really shameful. So money is a factor, certainly, and it's been a long, long time since we've invested any resources into this child welfare system. I think for many years it's been sort of on autopilot, and we forgot to put more gas in the system, so it's been running out of gas. We've had a lot of change in leadership over the years. I've actually sort of lost count of how many
yes.
leaders, but that means that it's it's hard to sustain a system of improvement when you constantly have this churn at the top. We have seen in the community-based provider arena a great deal of churn at the front lines as well, because the resources haven't changed over literally. This is the first big influx of resources in about 18 years. The amount of resources that we were able to devote to frontline workers has shrunken over time as other costs have grown. And so we have workforce turnover of about 50% across the system. And that sounds like certainly an administrative hassle, but really it has a big impact on children and families. Research shows that every time a worker turns over, it adds 6 months more to the child's stay in the child welfare system.
Well, and I'm sure that during the period of the budget impasse, when basically the social service safety net was fraying mm-hmm. exponentially, you know, there were a number of people that left doing that kind of child welfare social services. And these are devoted people.
These are tough jobs.
Yeah.
These are very tough jobs. You know, the budget impasse had far-reaching impacts on Illinois and people who rely on the services of the state to sort of weather life storms and get through tough spots. And it's not an accident, I don't think, that we've seen from 2014 to 2018, calls to the child welfare hotline increased by 20% and intakes coming into the system increased by 30%. And that's because a lot of the services outside of child welfare that help keep families together were failing. So mental health services, housing, substance abuse treatment, home visiting programs, all kinds of prevention programs, domestic violence programs, all of those kinds of things were failing at a massive rate across the state. And we did not have, you know, nobody was prepared for that. Nobody thought this was going to happen. We didn't plan for it. And so, you know, DCFS is a system of last resort. When things fall apart for people, kids are, you know, the ones who pay the price.
So where do we stand with DCFS right now?
So, you know, we are thrilled to say that the General Assembly and the governor have agreed to add more than $100 million in new resources to the DCFS system. This will, as you mentioned, allow DCFS to hire additional caseworkers and investigators who work on the very front lines, who are the people when, you know, a call is made. They're the ones who go out and visit and investigate and try to see what's really happening in the home. But it will also allow, on the private sector side, for us to address that workforce crisis that I was talking about, try to stabilize our workforce, get better training for everyone across the system on both the community side and the public side, and really start to think about how do we build a child welfare system that drives towards the outcomes children and family deserve.
See, I think a lot of people forget about what a crucial component the community service aspect is in child welfare.
We care for more than 80% of the children in DCFS system. So it's a tremendous amount. And it's a vital, you know, it's like, I don't even feel comfortable saying us versus them, because it's not. It's like the child welfare system is state funded, and it has state employees, and it has private community-based providers that work together hand in hand to try to address the challenges facing children who've been abused or neglected.
We're speaking with Andrea Durbin. She is the CEO of the Illinois Collaboration on Youth. We're talking about issues regarding DCFS. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the Allstate Skyline studio by Andrea Durbin, CEO of the Illinois Collaboration on Youth. We're talking about issues involving the Department of Children and Family Services. And Andrea, I know that in May there was a report that was given to the Pritzker administration as it looks to try to, you know, move this agency forward. And I know, you know, your agency too has, mm-hmm. has made plenty of recommendations. What's the future here?
Well, you know, the child welfare system is really in a crisis across the board, in a systemic crisis. And I think the temptation when we read a horrible story in the newspaper or see it on the evening news is, you know, lawmakers and others, we understandably want to fix that problem. But the problem is that that gets us into a sort of a whack-a-mole situation where you solve one problem, but you've neglected the others. Really, what we need is, of course, across-the-board systemic reform. The report that you're referring to was done by Chapin Hall, and it specifically looked at one piece of the child welfare system, which is called Intact Family Services. And that's where investigators have investigated a home, and they've determined that there may be abuse or neglect there, but that they believe the child can safely remain in the home with supports. And so that was that particular service was what Chapin Hall was taking a look at.
We were speaking off the air here about, you know, people say just, well, you have to take the child away.
Well,
I mean, it's not that simple.
No, it is not. Number one, removing a child from the home is always traumatic. It's not a benign experience. The child experiences it as trauma to separate children and parents, even in situations where you may say they would be better off. You know, it's on paper. You know, people have bonds of family, and that's important. Number two, across the nation, the biggest reason why children come into child welfare services attention is for neglect. And neglect looks a whole lot like poverty. And so when we think about how do we support families and address some of the challenges they're facing, you know, you wouldn't want someone to come in and take your children away because you're poor and you're struggling and maybe your housing circumstances aren't ideal, or you really need you left your child with you know, not an ideal child babysitter while you were trying to get to your job. And, you know, like there's a lot of complicating factors here. I think our job as it's the Department of Children and Family Services, as you reminded me, and that's important to remember that it's the goal is to try to keep families together.
And that's the ideal goal. Mm-hmm. It's not possible in all circumstances.
Not in all circumstances, of course not. And that's where we try to find permanent, loving, adoptive homes or extended family who can permanently take on the guardianship of those children. Kids should not grow up in foster care.
So you say this agency has been in turmoil and it's been going on for quite some time and the problems are systemic. We have this one report on the intact families. What about the rest of this agency?
Well, you know, there's been quite a bit of media attention also to a situation that the lingo calls it beyond medical necessity. These are children who are stuck in psychiatric hospitals, in jails and detention centers because there isn't a place for them outside. And I was talking to someone at Lurie Children's Hospital recently who said they had a child living in the hospital for 13 months because there wasn't an appropriate placement for that child outside of the hospital. And a hospital is not a place to grow up. There's no reason, right? When you think about what the impact is on that child, it's actually very traumatizing for a kid to be, they feel abandoned, and it can cause their trauma symptoms to be escalated. But also we're spending tremendous resources to keep someone in a psychiatric hospital when they don't need to be.
So where is the outplacement for those?
So, you know, it's in perhaps a residential treatment program that's that can offer structure and healing so that then a child can step down maybe and back into a foster home. But like a psychiatric hospitalization is meant to be addressing acute episode, right? And then once a person is stabilized, then they can move into, a more regular treatment program. Over the last 5 years or so, Illinois has lost more than 500 residential treatment center beds, primarily due to cost. We've got organizations that have closed their residential treatment centers because they could not afford to keep them open. Meaning, I'll give you an example. I have a provider out in Western Illinois who's actually, they've been operating at 50% capacity because she cannot keep a stable workforce. Because her workforce turnover is so great that she can't staff her facility of 28 beds. She's down to like 14 because that's the only, she can't have an unsafe environment for her staff, for the clients, the young people who would live there. And that's been happening across the board. And in Central Illinois, we had
I was going to say, this seems particularly acute. Maybe it's just because of the way I look at things anecdotally that it's been acute in downstate.
It's been a real problem. We had a provider in the Bloomington area that tried for several years to control costs on their residential treatment center, and their board was chipping in about $800,000 a year to try to stabilize that program, and they eventually decided that wasn't sustainable. That's a lot of money for them to cough up through galas and golf outings and, philanthropic donations and things like that. So, really, those children, this is why DCFS is in court a lot. Those children have civil rights. And the state, when we make the decision to remove children from their parents, we become their parents. And we have a legal obligation to provide them with, services, education, housing, all of that we provide for our own children. And it's too bad that organizations have had to try to rely on philanthropic dollars to make up the gap between what the state provides and what kids need.
So has that the reimbursement from the state gotten better?
Well, the great news is that in this most recent budget that was just signed, starting July 1st, we've been told that providers will all be getting an across-the-board 5% rate increase. Plus, there's some additional resources in those contracts to reduce the supervisory to caseworker ratio down to 5-1, which is really helpful. To provide in foster care contracts for some additional position to help recruit new foster parents, because that's a real challenge across the state, especially in downstate and rural communities that are really hit hard by the opioid epidemic, where we have lots of kids coming into care and we need more foster parents. So to have additional staff to recruit foster parents and train them and license them is going to be really helpful too. So there's a number of strategies. I would like to caution you, though, this is just the beginning of a reform. We got here over 20 years. We're not going to get out of here in one.
Well, and that's what I was going to say is, so you know, what's there to keep monitoring progress?
So, you know, of course, across the nation, every state is held to certain child welfare indicators. It's called the Child and Family Services Review, and there's seven indicators. On the last report, Illinois failed on all seven. So it'd be great to see us. To be fair, no state in the nation achieved all seven, but we got zero. So let's move forward and have better progress on reducing child maltreatment, increasing safety, reducing lengths of stay in the child welfare system. Our system, we're more than double the national average for length of stay in the child welfare system. So that alone could make a big difference in, you
sure.
know,
in
how it operates. Right, exactly.
Why are we at double?
Why are we? Well, I mean, for a long time, we were, when I said we had led the nation, we were one of the places in the country where we took in fewer kids. We were more discriminating at the front door. And we took in fewer kids. So people said, well, if you take in fewer kids, you're taking in the harder cases, and it's naturally going to have a little bit longer length of stay. But we've now been in that place for several years. And so I think that's not quite correct anymore. As I said, caseworker turnover is really closely related to length of stay in the system. So if you have a worker turnover, and like I said, we've got about 50% turnover a year, every worker turnover adds 6 more months to a child's length of stay.
We did get a caller who, if you know, wants to know if there's any contact information for parents looking for help. What you might recommend.
Certainly. Well, the Illinois Department of Human Services offers resources. I mean, I think if someone suspects child abuse or neglect, there's 1-800-25-ABUSE. That's the Child Abuse and Neglect Hotline. You know, depending on where you live, you can look at organizations in your community. On our website, which is icoyouth.org, we have a list of all of our community providers, and you could certainly call one of those organizations. There is, I'm not aware though of a general hotline,
sure,
for families who want help. But I think the Illinois Department of Human Services would be a good place to start if you're looking for like home visiting programs or things like that.
That's Andrea Durbin. She is CEO of the Illinois Collaboration on Youth. I know she'll be keeping an eye on hopeful progress being,
yes,
made at the Department of Children and Family Services. Andre, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good morning and welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. With the president's own internal polling showing him trailing former Vice President Joe Biden in Wisconsin, Florida, and Pennsylvania, the president resorted to his usual claims, fake news.
Mr. President, are you concerned about your internal polling as it relates to Joe Biden?
No, because we have great internal polling. They were fake polls that were released by somebody that is, it's ridiculous. No, we are winning in every single state that we've polled. We're winning in Texas very big. We're winning in Ohio very big. We're winning in Florida very big. They were fake polls that were either put out by the corrupt media, because much of the media in this country, unfortunately, is corrupt. I have to tell you that, Mr. President. And some of it is excellent, but some is very bad. Those are fake numbers. But you know when you're going to see that? You're going to see that on Election Day. On Election Day, you're going to see. It was the same thing. I had the same thing for...
Some of your advisors...
I had the same thing for a long period of time. In 2016, I was getting these terrible poll numbers, and I didn't see it because I'd have tremendous crowds and my opponent would have almost nobody. And I said, I think we're going to win the state of Michigan. We did. I think we're going to win the state of Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and we won them all. And now I have the same stuff. They're giving out phony polls. No, these are polls that we have that nobody saw. We do very little polling because I'm not a huge believer in polling. I think you go out there and you fight and you don't really need polls. You need ideas more than polls. But we have some internal polling, very little, and it's unbelievably strong. The strongest I've ever been is exactly today.
So he terms it fake news, but that is until the Trump campaign confirmed that the polling data being reported by ABC News was indeed internal polling data from the Trump campaign. The Trump campaign did say, though, that it was old data from March and that the president's support has grown since then. Well, we're going to move things much more local now, and joining me here in the Allstate Skyline studio is my Tribune colleague, John Byrne, City Hall correspondent. Mr. Byrne, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Happy Father's Day.
And to you as well. I appreciate you coming in because I've been spending the last several weeks, I think, with a focus on Springfield.
Right on.
Given the end of session and J.B. Pritzker's first session as governor. But I think, you know, it's time to take a bit of an assessment now, a month in office, for all practical purposes.
Yeah, Wednesday's the month of the inauguration for Mayor Lightfoot, I think.
And what is the relationship between the mayor's office and this city council?
Well, I think I would say evolving. I think the city council is still trying to figure it out. And I think that as a new mayor who's coming in and trying to get her feet under her, she's trying to figure it out too. Clearly, there's a feeling that she's going to be different from her predecessor, but Emanuel was this consummate political guy and was...
Well, you knew what you were getting
to an extent, yeah. And you had her running as an outsider and attacking the establishment, which had aldermen back on their heels. And then she came into office, and some aldermen I know that I've spoken to have been surprised that she seems serious about continuing those attacks. They figure, all right, you won. Time for us all to do our thing where we get along, and she's still pressing forward with this very serious move to root out corruption, which is what, you know, she wins as this outsider who's going to root out corruption. And I think there were a fair number of aldermen who figured that, all right, come on, it's
okay,
the campaign's
right.
Over. Let's do the thing where we get together and let bygones be bygones. And you know, she's a former federal prosecutor. She's not a politician, and she's still treating them in this. Well, no, I mean, you guys are bad news, and they're sort of taken aback by that.
Well, when I was down in Springfield for the end of session, everybody on the House and Senate floor was talking about her smackdown of Alderman Ed Burke.
Oh, man. Yeah.
As kind of the introductory salvo.
Right, right. He stood up and talked about the use of he or she as the pronouns in the city council rules. And I wonder, I almost wonder whether he was trying in a way to acknowledge the fact that we have a woman who's mayor and very clumsily trying to make some statement about, well, we should use the pronoun she in these rules. But she was clearly ready for him to try something on that first day. And as soon as he stood up, she did. She put him in his place and said, I'll call on you when I want to hear from you. He's used to kind of orating from the floor, even in his diminished under indictment role. I think he figured, well, I'm going to stand up. I'm going to say some Burke things about the history of Chicago and blah, blah, blah.
Sure, I'm the dean.
Right. And my many decades, here we are. And she cut him off short and sat him down. And that was an indication of how things were going to go.
And I guess, was that also maybe to set a tone?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. She was putting her cards on the table. This is how things are going to be here now. And then there was another incident at her second meeting during the public
comment.
Speaking section at the beginning of the meeting. Emanuel was very detached from that. He would be holding private meetings up at the front while people were at the microphone airing their grievances. Lightfoot is up there taking notes and has talked to a couple of people. And then this guy from the FOP got up there, Pat Murray, the vice president of the FOP, And he said, he was speaking directly to the mayor and said, you need to bring us to the table. We need to have a better relationship. You can't, you'll have a hard time getting done what you need to get done if you don't work with the Fraternal Order of Police. And as soon as he finished speaking, she dressed him down on the floor from the dais, said, if you guys are obstructionists, if you want to stop obstructing reform, I'll be happy to meet with you, but you haven't shown any indication that you're going to do that. People applauding and yelling stuff in the chambers. It was something else.
I'll call you. Don't call me.
Yeah. No, it was a definite, she was putting her cards on the table with them in a very, very public way. And we've seen this. She's, whereas,
don't go there just yet, right, because okay. I want to ask you about, okay. Yes, as we talk about tone and tenor.
Got it.
From the new mayor. We're speaking with John Byrne, my Tribune colleague who covers City Hall. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the Allstate Skyline studio by my good friend and Tribune colleague, John Byrne. He covers City Hall. We're talking about the first month of Mayor Lori Lightfoot's tenure and about setting tone and tenor. And she seems to be getting involved in sometimes extraneous arguments.
Right. Yeah. There, you know, it's different to be, as you and I were discussing, it's different to be an outsider who's running as an outsider and is free to sort of pick your, to fight in many different fronts and to be the mayor
and speak for the city.
Speak for the city. Yeah. Yeah. There was, there have been a few instances where maybe she wishes she had, kept her powder dry rather than publicly. And she's been very accessible and she's been, you know, you go to events and she'll turn to the media and start taking questions almost, you know, several times a day even. So it's been refreshing, but from our perspective, but I wonder if her staff is wishing that she had, you know, kept some things to herself occasionally.
And maybe messaging.
Yeah. Yeah, there's, you know, she's got a staff. They're trying to figure things out too. But yeah, she says what's on her mind. It seems like there was this incident with Riccio, who went on vacation, the second in command of the police department, and she apparently had issued a directive that the top white shirts, should not be going on vacation during the summer. He had a vacation scheduled to Aruba, and she stopped short of saying his job was in jeopardy, but sort of publicly said, like, maybe his job's in jeopardy. So now she's in a situation where she's fighting with him and with Eddie Johnson, the superintendent, who okayed the vacation for Riccio, and so now it just seems like it's a difficult situation for her. Now, does she go ahead and fire the guy? Does she say, on second thought, I'm not going to fire him? I don't know.
Aren't there other battles to fight?
You know, she says it's important to her, but that these guys be on duty during the summer, and I understand that. But yes, right, maybe there are other battles that she would rather be fighting right now than trying to decide whether she's going to follow through on firing the second command at the police department for taking a vacation he had scheduled back in October. I don't know.
Well, and one of those battles is the state's or the city's finances. And the story that you wrote that you kindly let me help you with.
I've carried that
today.
Story, Rick. Thank you.
But you know, it wasn't shortly, you know, after her victory that she went to Springfield and talked about.
With much fanfare.
And yes, and spoke to both the House and Senate and was hitting the ground running. Going to have a menu list of things that I need help from Springfield, even at one point almost sounding like a veiled threat, like if you want a graduated income tax, you're going to need my help.
Right, that whole we go first.
Right. And so we get to Springfield and really find out there really wasn't any menu.
Right.
There were some things. I mean, winning a casino for Chicago is certainly significant.
Certainly. Not going to help this year, though.
Well, that's it. It's nothing. And yes, the graduated income tax proposal goes on the ballot in 2020.
Not going to help this year.
Not going to help.
Right.
And so now it's, well, be prepared to go to the well.
And the well is, as we've all learned so well these past few years, tends to be the property tax.
Right. And the most hated tax.
Right.
Of all.
Right. And there are lots of people on the city council who are saying, you know, she's going to, and we'll see. The city council talks a big game, these guys.
especially now, in some regards,
talk a big game, yes. And they usually fall in line. But they're saying, you know, she's coming on really strong on this whole idea of cleaning us up and hitting us for being corrupt. Let's see how she feels about the way she's treating us when she comes to us in a few months and asks us to raise property taxes by $700 million or whatever it's going to be, you know, and
right.
She's going to have to round up votes and she's doing a lot of the hammering us and far too little of the velvet glove approach to getting us on her side. So we will see.
Show some love to the city council.
Show some love. I'm sure if you said that.
I never thought I would ever utter those words.
Right, right. No, and she, and you know, she's not a politician. If you right. said that to her, she would probably theatrically roll her eyes and give an exasperated sigh and say, these people are, you know, they need to clean up their act.
Right, right. Well, John Byrne, City Hall correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, keeping an eye on everything going on over there, or as best he can.
As best I can.
And it's not always in plain eyesight either, I might add. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the Allstate Skyline studio by my good friend and former Tribune colleague, Bob Sector. And Bob, thank you so much. Happy Father's Day. And
same to you.
I was kind of thinking of both of us having had experience in Springfield.
that's a nice way of putting it.
At various points in our career. And then this kind of viral thing happens, the saga of Joe Crane. Joe Crane was the WICS Channel 20 weatherman. That's the ABC affiliate owned by Sinclair Broadcasting Company. And I don't know Joe. I didn't know him. I was just down in Springfield last week, you know, or 2 weeks ago from the end of session. You turn on the TV in the morning, there's Storm Team 20's forecast, you know, your news leader in Central Illinois, but you're watching this, and it's a relative starter market for TV broadcasting, and so you end up with a lot of very young people on. And then there's Joe Crane, kind of an older, steady hand, you know, a veteran kind of voice, and providing some confidence to viewers. Then there was the issue of being told corporate-wide by Sinclair, known for its corporate-wide edicts, that, well, if there's some bad weather in the area, you have to do a code red alert. And this even made Stephen Colbert.
This controversy involving WICS, Springfield, Illinois' news leader, they were told by their corporate owners that every time there was any bad weather, everything from a tornado to a light drizzle, they had to announce it to their viewers with the graphic code red. The theory behind the code red is that it's exciting, it's grabbing, and more people would keep watching if you scare them until their pants are at code brown. Here's the thing, though. It's not all that informative. So viewers complained to the station with thousands of comments on social media, letters to the editor, frequent calls to local talk radio shows. Wow. Does this town consist entirely of old people? Dear television, I don't like the weather forecast changed. Also, Lorna Dunes are too pointy. Enter our hero, WICS meteorologist and Norse god of beige, Joe Crane. Crane was the weatherman there. Crane heard the calls of the people and went on air to take a stand.
We want you to know it's not us. This is a corporate initiative, the Code Red Alert. And behind the scenes, many of us have tried to dissuade it for the last few months to try something else that's less controversial to the viewers. So keep in mind, despite the fact that this facility is owned by a corporation, it's still licensed under the authority by the Federal Communications Commission to serve the public interest, convenience, and necessity.
And that got Joe Crane fired.
Yes, it did. And you know what's interesting about it is that that's not the most offensive thing that the ownership group of that station does. So, I mean, it's owned by Sinclair Broadcasting, which almost bought the station, right?
It almost bought Tribune Broadcasting.
Mm-hmm. And
I don't think I would see Mr. Skilling doing Code Red alerts.
No, but, you know, we were all joking or shuddering or whatever it is about whether the WGN was going to have to do these must runs, which where they have very right-wing commentary aimed at supporting their buddy, the President of the United States.
Boris Epstein.
Boris Epstein. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Among others.
Yeah. And you do not deviate from that. And luckily for Chicago and many other cities, that deal fell apart. But they'll be back next year when they are in partnership with the Cubs, right?
Yes, they are running
the cable network.
They're running the marquee network.
So we'll see what they do with sports.
Well, they do have the tennis channel.
Well,
I can't say that I've seen the tennis channel.
No, I have not.
But Sinclair Broadcasting runs the tennis channel as well. So. Yes.
This is the future.
That's the future as we know it. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you again for coming in, and I thought you would enjoy a little Channel 20 drama.
I'm so old. That used to be the NBC affiliate. I don't know when that changed.
I believe it was during the time of high ratings for Monday Night Football.
Okay.
That's, yes. But anyway, I kind of wanted to get your take on Governor Pritzker and this very activist agenda that he put in place, and the fact that legislators largely complied with it.
Yeah, and it's interesting that a lot of the Republican side of the aisle went along with it, too. And you've got to think that those guys, even though Bruce Rauner was their, provided them with all the resources they needed to try to get reelected, and obviously didn't work out that well for them. But those guys, to some extent, have got to be really happy to see Bruce Rauner gone.
Except now they have to fend for their own for money.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But, you know, he was very hard for the Republican side of the aisle to deal with. Remember the grand bargain that a couple years ago that they all thought they had worked out, and then Rauner came in and scuttled it? And, which is why several people on the Republican side of the aisle finally broke ranks and voted for a compromise budget.
Well, and Senate Republican leader Christine Rodonio left.
Yes, absolutely.
I just wonder where goeth the Republicans.
Well, it's interesting because, Illinois is sort of an island in the Midwest. I mean, we are we're the one clearly Democratic state, the downstate secessionists, notwithstanding. There's not a lot of... It's going to be a long time, I would suspect, before the Republican Party comes back in any meaningful way. Although you can see that part of Pritzker's agenda has been raising taxes, and that has the tendency to create a backlash. So if you're going to campaign on something, that would be it.
Well, when you look at the fact, with the fact of the $45 billion capital improvement bill, which relies on expanded gambling, it relies on doubling the gas tax, it relies on increased license plate fees, a cigarette tax increase. Obviously, Republicans, I think, for the most part, felt that after the previous term of Bruce Rauner, they didn't have much to show for those 4 years. And at least with Capitol, yes, there's the odorous tax increase, hold your nose, but there is also the advantage of having those ribbon-cutting ceremonies as you see tangible improvements in your community.
Yeah, the interesting thing will come next March when we'll see how many of, well, we'll actually know before then, but we won't know the results till then, how many of the Republicans get primaried by candidates farther to their right. And we'll see how that works out, whether they, you know, whether the polarization continues or whether they can ride that out.
Yeah, and I think, you know, obviously, as we've seen, the divides are very great now between, and it's not just Chicago and the rest of the state, but those divides are getting murkier because when you look at the collar counties.
Yeah, it's just the collar counties are getting more blue all the time. And so what's left of the Republican Party there is getting farther, is getting more red. And, you know, it's a great recipe for having candidates on the fringes prevailing in a primary, but not prevailing in a general election.
We're speaking to Bob Sector, my good friend and former Tribune colleague. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Skyline studio with my good friend Bob Sector, my former Tribune colleague and one-time editor. We still speak to each other regardless of that.
I apologize for everything I did.
Yeah, right. You never apologized once.
Well, I'm doing it now.
Okay, fair enough, fair enough. So we have the first Democratic presidential debates coming up in just a couple of weeks. And you've got, I forget, I know there's 23 candidates.
Yeah, and but, three didn't qualify for some reason.
Right,
either.
And so you've got the orange group and the purple group. I don't know what that means, but that's NBC.
So at least it's not code red.
Yeah, thank you, yes, yes. Which is now weather worn, I've been informed.
Okay,
not to be confused. So the purple group, you've got Michael Bennett, Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, Kirsten Gillibrand, John Hickenlooper, Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders, and a few others. That's a pretty big lineup there. And then on the orange group, Cory Booker, Julian Castro, Bill de Blasio, Tulsi Gabbard, Jay Inslee, Amy Klobuchar, Beto O'Rourke, and Elizabeth Warren. 2 hours of debate each night.
Okay, and who's going to watch all this?
I don't know. Well, we'll have to.
Well,
some of us will.
Some of us will. Is there a ball game on that night?
I'm sure there is. But I, that just, at what point does the Democratic field start winnowing?
Well, let's be fair, it hasn't even started yet. We have not had the first debate. Remember, 4 years ago about this time, we had those endless Republican debates with 17 people on stage at some point.
Well, you had the adult table and then the kids table.
Right.
Which,
it's partly what enabled Donald Trump to insult his way into the presidency, because he just commanded attention because everybody else had, 2 minutes to speak, and he would sit around and insult everybody, and that's what made all the headlines.
So isn't there that potential of one of these lower polling candidates trying to use this as a dominative kind of bullying force?
Sure, but they're Democrats.
Well, what does that mean?
Because they just sort of don't do that. There's a lot of kumbaya, and they're going to, they're attempting to play by some set of rules, and there isn't, as far as I know, maybe I'm forgetting somebody, there's not a Donald Trump among them. The perhaps the closest thing you're going to get is Bernie Sanders, and he's not into insulting other people. He's into ripping the Donald Trump to pieces, and the business world and capitalism and everything else.
Well, but I still wonder if we aren't going to see, because we still have a Democratic Party here, much as kind of what we saw from 4 years ago with the Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, kind of this kind of a party that's polarized.
Extremely so. And Joe Biden obviously is a lot more akin to the Hillary Clinton school of politics than
the establishment wing.
Correct.
You might say.
Correct. Now, are they going to start attacking him for his policies or for his willingness to talk to Republicans? I don't know.
You've kind of seen that already. I mean, look at the flip flop on the Hyde Amendment, for example.
Sure. Okay, and so he did that, but it's interesting. Once someone changes their mind and admits it, once someone says, "Whoopsies, I screwed up. That was wrong," it's really hard to continue to attack them.
Is it though? No. I mean, given the issue of women's reproductive health in the Democratic Party, that it just became a dawning awareness on Joe Biden's part?
Joe Biden, as he said, has been around a long time and seen and done a lot. So, there's a lot of other things that he's flip-flopped on as well. So what's the line of attack? Is that you're not sincere now? I mean, remember Obama actually pushed by something Joe Biden did, changed his mind on gay marriage.
Right.
So, it's been a consistent, Democrats have taken the position that they can, quote unquote, evolve. But this thing on abortion was somewhat sudden for Biden. But is that going to be the cutting edge issue of the Democratic primaries? I simply don't know. But there's a lot. There's a lot more that they're alike than they are the variety of candidates than they are separate.
Well, and I've already noticed we're talking about kind of the changing suburbs here too, and so you've got Sean Casten, that Democrat defeated in the 6th congressional district in DuPage, now is facing a challenge, a Republican contender who's Evelyn Sanguinetti, the former Lieutenant Governor under Bruce Rauner, and every missive that they send out is attacks Casten as Democratic Socialist.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing, because nobody really knows what that means, and Bernie Sanders is most associated with that term, and he hasn't really defined it very well either, although I've heard him in the last few days.
Yeah, he's been trying to.
And he's defining it as saying is that Republicans believe in socialism for the wealthy and capitalism for everybody else. And I don't know if that's an effective tool, but they're trying to equate the chaos in Venezuela somehow to the term democratic socialism, which is kind of a stretch, but it might work with some people. I don't know.
It's going to be a long, long campaign season ahead.
Yes, it is.
I was on MSNBC last week, and Jay Inslee was also on, the governor there, who referred to Des Moines. And I'm thinking, man, it's got a long way to go here if you don't know how to pronounce the Iowa capital city.
Who was it? Who was the Republican candidate for president of like two cycles ago? Oh, it was Michelle Bachmann, who mistook a town. She made a mistake about a town in Iowa. What was it? It wasn't Storm Lake, was it? But she didn't understand some of the history of the town, which is a bad thing to do in a primary election in Iowa.
Exactly. Or be the Republican candidate, a Republican candidate or a Democratic candidate campaigning during the Iowa State football game. Not a good idea either. Bob Sector, my good friend and former Tribune colleague, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
No problem.
We'll be back with more right after this.